This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will have Danny Heitman, editorial writer for the Baton Rouge Advocate, with us to discuss what's going on in our community and with the major players in the political world, from Governor Jindal to Mayor Holden to former police chief Dwayne White. We'll talk about a few different items with Danny Heitman. Also, Margie O'Meara, she is a political consultant on the national level, a young Democrat who is handling some prominent politicos from the Democratic side of the spectrum. She will talk about the president's second term and where Congress is going from here. And Joey Watson on TED at LSU. All this, now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers, if you wish to dial in and join the conversation, 877-217-5757, wherever you are. And if you're dialing locally, 297-5633. Inkstershow at WRKF.org for email. And our guest to begin is Danny Heitman. For 22 years, he's been a columnist with the Baton Rouge Advocate.
Oh, Danny boy. the pipes are calling.
Kevin Gallagher gives you a theme song. You're in the high cotton, Danny Heitman, whose columns appear in The Advocate as well. He and Lanny Keller do most of the heavy lifting on the opinion page. And, of course, The Advocate has something to say every day, including today's lead editorial about the exit of Pope Benedict, which was written by one Danny Heitman, who also writes for The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post. His work has appeared in The New York Times, The Christian Science Monitor, and many other national places. Danny Heitman, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim, and thank you for the Danny Boy rendition. Kevin couldn't possibly know this, but my dear late departed dad used to sing Danny Boy to me. So,
is that why you were named Danny?
Actually, not. He was inspired to sing the song because I was named Danny, but I cannot hear that song without getting misty-eyed. So that was a treat for me to hear that, and I appreciate that. And good morning, Jim.
Good morning. And you've just earned a Master of Humanities degree from California State University. So you were commuting from here to the Golden State? Is that how that was working?
Well, that was an interesting process. I actually did the degree online. California State University has had an external degree program where you can actually study off campus. They've had that since the 1970s, before the age of the Internet. People would do it through postal correspondence. It's an accredited and respected program. My dear friend Bob Mann is an alumnus of the program. He got a master's degree there as well. And I did it entirely online, and that was an interesting experience. Since I was signed up as a student at California State, I was actually on their texting system for their emergency alerts, and so I would get alerts on my phone here in Louisiana about earthquake drills and things of that sort, and that was interesting to be a remote student here in Louisiana but yet still be considered part of the campus.
Did you have to write a thesis?
I did. I completed my thesis last year in December, turned it in, it was approved, and my degree should be arriving in the mail any day now.
What was the focus of the thesis?
My thesis was on, it concerned how literary figures of the past have confronted middle age. And my idea there is that we tend to think of midlife change as a modern phenomenon, but people back in antiquity were still touched by this question. And so that's what my thesis was about, was going back in history and seeing how historical figures...
What are you talking about? Distant middle agers, right? Middle agers in the middle age,
right? Exactly. One of them, of course, being someone from the 1800s, John James Audubon. Mm-hmm. I've written a book about him, but he kind of had a midlife crisis, and that's what got me thinking about this concept of middle age, not as a new phenomenon, but as something that people of antiquity also confronted.
That would be something also that would be interesting to carry forward to more contemporary times, because people do make changes in middle age, and quite often fabulous writers have some sort of epiphany. For my friend, Ernest Gaines, you know, he came back to his old homestead in Louisiana. Ernest Hemingway, another Ernest, he decided to take his life in middle age.
Right, and the more I studied this question, the more I learned how universal it is, not only through time, but across the world. And it's a theme I'm continuing to study, and perhaps I'll write more about it beyond my thesis.
Okay, well, let's get this out of the way. The Advocate, as reported, is for sale for the right price, and there is a person in the offing who is negotiating. Is that causing any kind of uncertainty at the newspaper right now?
Well, I think everybody at the newspaper and the community at large is naturally curious about it. I think Mr. George's, John George's, has expressed an interest in buying the paper. Of course, he owns, among many other things, he owns Galatoire's restaurants. My first question was whether I would get an employee discount if he did purchase the Advocate. But I don't know anything about those negotiations beyond what's been reported in the paper. I do try to remind myself as a journalist that ultimately, if you're a journalist, you work for your audience, you work for your readers, and it's our job, whoever owns the Advocate, to really make sure that our readers are serviced and make sure that they get the news they need when they need it. And so that's what I'm going to continue to endeavor to do.
Well, John George's, when he was running for governor, he was on this show several times. He's a fascinating fellow. Once saved the life of Peter Frampton, many years ago.
I did not know that. Yeah. I've never met Mr. George's.
Yeah, and he's a guy who loves the limelight. But if you had told me a decade or so ago that John George's might be buying the Advocate and the Advocate would be housed at the headquarters of Jimmy Swaggart Ministries, I would have said, I don't know about that. But
one of the things that has kept me in journalism is I like surprises. And, and if you live in South Louisiana, every morning brings new surprises, and that's what gets you out of bed in the morning, right?
You're right, and it's always synonymous with the news coverage. You never know what's going to happen in Louisiana, and it's a cliche, but in our case, it's true. With 4.5 million people, we generate news that America usually is interested in, and much of it has to do with New Orleans, of course, but not all of it.
Well, sure. I was told for many years that the wire services, of course, AP is still with us and UPI not so much, but I was told that the wire services would routinely send reporters to Louisiana, to the state capitol, to kind of break them in, because if you can cover politics in Louisiana, you can cover it anywhere nationally and internationally. That's a boot camp for anybody, and I think that continues to be true. We have such a lively political culture here, and as you pointed out many times on your show, we generate much more news than our modest population would suggest.
You started at The Advocate, what, in 1990 or 91?
I became a columnist in 1991. I started with the State Times in 1986, fresh out of college, and then when the State Times closed in 1991, I moved to The Advocate as a feature writer and a columnist.
There are people in this community, of course, who don't remember that at one time we had two thriving newspapers in the same office building, but nonetheless different staffs, and the State Times had some outstanding people working there, notably in sports, but in other realms as well. But you know, I think of George Morris and Sam King and some of the Dan Hardesty. But you cut your teeth there. It was an afternoon newspaper.
I remember those days with great fondness, and I think they were formative for me. Of course, being an afternoon newspaper, you would start your day at 7 in the morning, and for a young man who's 25 or so, those are not the kindest hours, but it was very intense in the mornings. We had two editions. We had a 10 o'clock deadline and a noon deadline, And gosh, once you got to lunch, you just felt like you had lived a week's worth of your life in a morning. And it was exhilarating and it was fun. And my work continues to be fun, but in a different way. But those were great times for me.
A giant asteroid is barreling.
Kevin, what happened? Did an asteroid hit us?
As I said, surprise. I get up for surprise, and that was certainly a surprise.
Well, Kevin is probably trying to get some material ready for our next topic, and that's the governor. The governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, the poll numbers this week do not show him doing very well. Do you make anything of this?
I don't find the poll numbers to be devastating in any way. I mean, Bobby Jindal continues to be the most influential political figure in Louisiana. I don't think it's uncommon for governors in their second terms or any chief executive in their second term to have dips in their poll numbers. I do think that it would benefit the governor to put himself in more situations in which he's actually engage with people who might disagree with him. I think that would make him a better governor. And also, if he does have national political aspirations, it'd make him a better national candidate. I think he's a very bright man. He's very capable, and he certainly has nothing to lose by engaging the public more.
Well, he has not done so in Louisiana, no doubt. Yesterday, he did take a few questions at the mansion. Marsha Schuler of the Advocate was there. And here's how the governor responded when he was queried about his sagging poll numbers.
Look, the only polls I care about are BCS polls. I'm glad to see the Tigers are ranked again high for the preseason polls. I've never been a politician or a governor that's worried about polls. That's not what we worry about. What we're focused on is the future of Louisiana. I'm more worried about that.
All right. But as responses go, that was one that was acceptable.
I don't know any political figure who does not read polls, and I would certainly think that Governor Jindal and his staff do read polls. But as I said, I don't find the poll numbers to be grave by any stretch. I think he's still a bright, capable, and talented politician. So,
but Danny, if lawmakers see these polls and they look at them as well, and they see the governor at 46% in one poll, 37 in another. And they think the governor is asking me to put my neck on the line and embrace a tax plan that is controversial. And the governor, by the way, needs 2/3 support in both chambers. If his poll numbers are not sufficient, he may have difficulty selling his plan.
If you have extremely high poll numbers, then you can say, pass this plan because I said so. If your poll numbers are not that great, then you have to say, pass this plan because A, B, C, D, and E, and you have to make a more vigorous and articulate and transparent explanation of your policies. And that's all to the good in Louisiana. And Bobby Jindal, of course, the Advocate, has taken him to task whenever we feel that he has fallen short. But he's a bright, capable, and articulate man, and I think he is more than able to explain his policies if he takes the time to engage the public, and he can certainly do that, and I would encourage him to do that.
2 years ago, when the governor sought re-election, he got 66% of the vote statewide in a field of candidates that was less than stellar. When I say less than stellar, the people just didn't have the resources to run a viable campaign. The most spent by any of his challengers was $18,000 by Tara Hollis, who finished second with 18% of the votes. She got 30% in Baton Rouge, over 30, 33%. The governor got 50% in his hometown, despite getting 66% of the ballots statewide. Here's how he responded to why he didn't do better in Baton Rouge.
Not to take anything away from your 66, but EBR...
Make sure you say that again. Not to take anything away. Oh, go ahead.
But EBR was like 50. I mean, what's up with that?
Well, I blame the Advocate. Absolutely. Next question.
He blamed you, Danny Heitman.
You know, I really wish... I'd be flattered to think that we had so much influence that we could do that. I mean, the only thing that we try to do is cover any sitting governor, any lawmaker, any mayor. We try to cover them vigorously, fairly, but also skeptically. You know, we try to ask tough questions because we think the public deserves that. That's how democracy works.
Danny Heitman with us for a bit longer. Now a professor at LSU, by the way. and we will talk with him about what's going on in our state and in our city after we return from this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Danny Heitman, editorialist for the Baton Rouge Advocate for the last 22 years, is with us. And your career as an editorial writer at the newspaper in Baton Rouge began right at the time of the Edwin Edwards-David Duke race. I'm sure that was an interesting time for you, as it was for the rest of us.
I was a lifestyle columnist in 1991 when I started as a columnist. I did not join the editorial board until 2004. So I was not on the editorial board staff for that race, but that was an interesting race, wasn't it? And speaking of surprises, if you had told me that Edwin Edwards would survive prison, get out, marry a beautiful blonde, and
52 years as junior.
That absolutely amazing. Again, you know, if you want to be surprised, be a journalist in South Louisiana.
Well, in order for Bobby Jindal to replicate what Edwin Edwards has done, he would have to be elected governor two more times. And it would mean that this governor's next wife, would be born 9 years from now. In 2022, and as I've noted a few times, if Edwin Edwards had gone the opposite direction, 52 years, he was born in 1927, his bride would have been born in 1875.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is, but he is a fascinating fellow, and reality television awaits.
It's these kinds of statistics that keep people tuning in to Jim Inkster. I mean, your capacity for math is amazing.
Well... Thank you. Well, the speaking of math, the governor he's going to have to sell this tax plan in order to get his wishes, and it's not going to be an easy chore with two-thirds support needed in both the House and the Senate. That means, talking about math, you got to have 70 votes in the House, 26 in the Senate. Do you think he can do it?
Well, Senator Sharon Wesson-Roone was on your show yesterday, I believe, and she talked about Governor Jindal's legislative outreach. He has certainly seems to be aggressive in reaching out to legislators and getting their input as he refines his tax plan. I would suggest that, you know, if you're going to do this, you should have town meetings across the state with the public and let the public have some face time with the governor and I think that's all the good if you want to sell it. I certainly think it's good public policy. So,
well, yesterday in his brief remarks, he said that every lawmaker's opinions would be sought and that they would be talked with. But I got the impression from the statement that he would talk with them, but that's not his style. He generally sends somebody else out to do the interviewing when it comes to interaction with lawmakers.
That's my understanding, and you know, perhaps the governor's trying to play catch-up here and develop more personal relationships with lawmakers. It's a bit late in the game to be doing that, but I think it's all the good for any governor to have direct and personal relationships with legislators, but also to engage the public on a regular basis.
Well, the mayor of the city has a more open engagement policy. He comes on this show, for example, and others, and he generally is accessible to the media. For a few days, he didn't want to talk about the firing of Chief Dwayne White, but now he is talking about him, and it's certainly a time in which those two are at odds with each other, less than 2 years after Chief White was unveiled as perhaps the savior to the crime situation. What's going on with the mayor and the now former chief?
As to whether Mayor Holden is accessible to the media, I don't know. I think that's an open question. We routinely call him for comment and don't get any, but I think it's interesting.
Well, I don't know if he likes the advocate. He's going to like the governor on that. He thinks the advocate, particularly one of your reporters, I think, he thinks the advocate's got some kind of axe to bear. And I don't believe that, but
sure.
But perception is reality.
We have routinely supported many of the mayor's proposals on the editorial page, and of course the mayor knows that. So And I actually wish the mayor well. If Mayor Holden succeeds and is an engaged and successful mayor, then that benefits me as a homeowner in Baton Rouge and as a taxpayer, and it benefits anybody who has a business here and wants to have children and grow a family here. So I wish the mayor well. As far as his firing of the chief, he started this dialogue by saying that he didn't discuss personnel matters in the media. And then, of course, 3 days later, or several days later, he released a letter explaining why he fired Chief White. Anytime a public official of such high responsibility as a police chief is fired, there's going to be natural public curiosity about it and natural public concern. And I just think it benefits everyone if we have an open, transparent explanation of what happened. That's why I think it's good for there to be a hearing at which Chief White can express his concerns and the mayor can express his concerns as well. I think that benefits everybody. In the absence of that kind of information, you have all sorts of speculation, mm-hmm. much of which some of which might be true and some of it which might not be true, and that doesn't benefit anybody.
The governor, apparently listening to Danny Heitman's remarks this morning, has called an 11 o'clock news conference. 297-5633 is your number. Charles on North Foster. Charles, you're on the air with Danny.
Good morning, Jim and Danny. Danny, my question would be, why would any council person, metro council person, oppose discussing electing the Baton Rouge Police Department chief? I think the gentleman from District 12, Mr. John Delgado, refused to even allow the discussion. So why would a metro councilman in a democracy in America oppose even discussing electing the Baton Rouge Police Department chief? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, Mr. Delgado is in a better position to discuss that than I would be, and I would think he'd be a great guest on Jim's show. Yeah. I would just say that, you know, I am always pro-discussion, and anytime there's a serious public policy proposal on the table, you know, councils are supposed to be deliberative bodies, and I am always in favor of open, transparent deliberation, so...
Well, Danny has noted he writes prolifically along with Lanny, Danny and Lanny, on the editorial pages of The Advocate every day, and he also writes the At Random column, and some of those have to do with lifestyle, where you began, and you wrote a recent column that I think is appropriate as we end our discussion with you about Sunday brunch. This is appropriate for Valentine's week. Tell us a bit about this ritual that included mid-morning pancakes, a shared newspaper, and strains of Vivaldi's The Four Seasons.
I wrote a column about a perfect Sunday morning that I experienced a few weeks ago. There was a marathon here in Baton Rouge. I woke up. It was a beautiful day. There were marathon runners going through our neighborhood, and some folks in my neighborhood in Old Goodwood had just come out, stood at the edge of their driveways to cheer on people that they didn't know who were running in this race. And to me, it kind of affirmed what is best about Baton Rouge and what I like about Baton Rouge. I really like the friendships that people develop here. I like the openness of the people, their generosity, and it just made me feel good, and I wanted to write about that.
Well, Danny Heitman writes as well as anybody in this great land of ours, and he happens to do it for the Baton Rouge Advocate, and has been writing columns for 22 years. Keep up the good work, and let's talk again soon. Danny Heitman.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care, my friend.
Bye.
And we're joined now by Margie Omero. She is a prominent Democratic political consultant based in the nation's capital, and she is here to talk with us about what's happening beyond the borders of Baton Rouge in Louisiana. Good morning to you, Margie.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get down to some of the items that are first and foremost in the news right now. What about Chuck Hagel? His confirmation as defense secretary has been held up by Republicans, his party. What's happening regarding the Hagel nomination?
Yeah, I think it's going to be it looks like it's going to be a bit of a challenge. It's going to be the first time ever that there's been a filibuster of a cabinet nominee. And, you know, I'm surprised because it reinforces this perception that Republicans simply want to just say no to anything the president does. It makes them look like they are doing this as political payback for a Republican senator who endorsed the president in his first campaign. Ultimately, Chuck Hagel has a record that is perfect for the job. He's somebody who wants to cut costs. He has two Purple Hearts. He has been a small businessman. He's been in the Senate. He's been already an advisor to the president on foreign affairs. He's an independent, and he's been endorsed by a wide range of former ambassadors to Israel, former national security advisors, folks who've been nominated by presidents of both parties. So it's just a sign that the fact that Hagel's nomination has been controversial, it's a sign of how partisan Washington has become, that everything is a fight. Every nominee, every treaty, every small bill, that's why you've had the past Congress being the least productive Congress we've had in history. I mean, this is the new normal in our Washington discourse.
Margie O'Meara, she is the founder of Momentum Analysis. That's her company, and recently named one of 50 Politicos to Watch by Politico and a mover and shaker by Politics Magazine. You are a pollster, and, of course, you crunch numbers. And next year shapes up as a big year as far as the U.S. Senate. Democrats will try to retain control, and one of the seats Republicans are eyeing is the one in Louisiana held by Mary Landrieu. What's your read from Washington on what's going on regarding the political scene in Washington for next year?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I mean, certainly the conventional wisdom has been that Democrats are going to have a tough road in the Senate. But the last time that was supposedly true about Democrats was this past election, where it was supposedly going to be a tough road for Democrats in the Senate, and we ended up gaining seats. So the thing about politics is that it doesn't matter if you're a pollster, or you're a professional handicapper, or you're an elected official. Wherever you sit this far out from an election will change. That is the only thing we can all agree on, that we know for sure that, it isn't a science. And that, there are so many things that can happen between now and then. We now have a situation nationally where Republicans have been moving farther to the right in order to defend themselves from primary challenges. And so that is sort of that has drawn the whole party over to the right. You have a lot of Democratic senators like Senator Landrieu, like others around the country, who have struck a more moderate tone, given the fact that they come from a redder state or a more purple state. Senator Landrieu has been through some tough elections, and I certainly wouldn't I wouldn't put her on the vulnerable list just yet, given that. That she's withstood a lot of tough challenges over the years and is still here.
Earlier, Margie, we were talking about some poll numbers for Governor Jindal that are not so swell in his home state. But now, as you know, as a pollster, you not only crunch the numbers, you do a lot of focus groups. What can you find out in a focus group that you can't find out from raw data that is dispensed in a survey?
Oh, it's a great question. Focus groups allow people to talk in their own words. When we do a survey, it's about testing assumptions, right? That's what research is. It's testing assumptions. When you do a survey, you are making assumptions just by what you leave out. You're saying, okay, well, this question is not important, so I'm leaving this out. Or this question wording is how people think about this issue. In a focus group, you're not making those kinds of assumptions. You're saying, hey, what's important to you? Tell me about what's going on in your life right now. Tell me how you view the candidates, and you don't know what you're going to get in response. You know, people are just speaking out in their own words. The difference is you can't project the results onto the population at large, so you can't say 30% of focus group participants said such and such. That's what you can do in a survey. You can't do that in focus groups. So as a specific example, this past week, actually, we did some focus groups for Walmart about with Walmart moms. We've been studying them for a few election cycles. They're a proven swing block. They're moms who have kids under 18 living at home. And what we asked them about, how your, you know, tell us about your lives and how you think the economy may or may not be impacting your life. And they tell us some really very personal stories about husbands who have been laid off or needing braces for their kids and how that's changing their family budget, or how they're changing their house or downsizing their house in order to account for changes in their home situation. And all of that is the kind of thing that you wouldn't get in a survey. And we're also able to show clips. So we showed a clip of the State of the Union. We said, okay, what do you think? Here's President Obama talking about preschool. What do you think? And they were really animated and said that would really be helpful, because for me to work full-time but have a part-time preschool for my kid, that just doesn't work logistically. So I would have to quit my job to then pay to take my kid to part-time preschool, and it puts the whole family dynamic in a completely different place. So that's the kind of thing that you can't get in a survey, that you can't get in a focus group, and it's incredibly informative.
What's going on regarding sentiments pertaining to guns and gun rights?
Well, gun rights. So that's, you know, that's an issue that is being discussed every single day here in Washington, whether it's in Congress or it's out in, you know, amongst everybody else in Washington. It is a topic on everybody's mind. And voters are ready for action. Over 90% of Americans say they want to see a background check for every single gun purchase. And that's something that NRA lobbyists have been fighting against, but it has overwhelming support from voters overall. There are other issues up for debate, other policies up for debate, whether it's an assault weapons ban or a ban on high-capacity magazines. Those things also have majority support, a majority support among Republicans and majority support among women. And if, you know, Republicans want to broaden their base down the road, they may want to look at some of these issues that that are less controversial among women. And when we see, when you see coverage that says NRA is popular, so we need to, you know, be mindful of that, they're actually not popular among women overall. So there is a real gender gap here on stronger gun laws that transcends party. So even among Democrats or among independents or among Republicans, women are even more likely to support stronger gun laws. But
can the president get anything done with Congress?
Well, you know, it goes back to the primary. You know, you have Republicans worried about primary challenges. They're worried about they've gerrymandered the districts so much. So there are districts now that have become so Republican, and other districts are so Democrat, that now there are fewer battlegrounds. And so you have a lot of members more worried about a primary challenge from the right than thinking about what voters in general election voters in their districts want. Not even general election voters elsewhere, just the general election voters in their district become less important. And that's troubling for our democracy. When you have something that 93% of Americans support, that you have Republicans now fighting, or you have elected officials thinking they can't support it because of a lobbying group and primary challenges, that just means that our government is now becoming less reflective of where the population is.
We'll be back with Margie O'Meara from Washington after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Margie O'Meara, founder of Momentum Analysis. She is a Democratic public opinion researcher, pollster, and consultant. And she is here to talk about the politics of Washington and beyond. 297-5633, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, please be brief. You're on with Margie. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Good morning, Margie. Yeah, first of all, could you talk about the ALEC agenda? I understand that that's a basically a legislative agenda for corporations and big business to get laws passed in state legislatures that that favor them.
All right. The ALEC agenda, Margie?
Yeah, you know, the ALEC agenda, I mean, that's a, you know, a conservative, and I couldn't hear all of what Phil was saying, but the ALEC agenda is, you know, something that is happening in a lot of state legislatures, and it doesn't get as much attention as it should. It's a, you know, conservative leaning group that works together to come up with bills that they can then find states and see which states would introduce them, and then if that works, then they'll take them to other states. And it's how we've seen some of the more extreme bills on immigration, also how we've seen bills like the Stand Your Ground law that was used as a defense in the Trayvon Martin shooting last spring in Florida. And it's something that, you know, is really it's happening. You know, you've seen other extreme gun laws. You know, even one state in Indiana, they voted to extend Stand Your Ground to include interactions with a police officer. So if you felt like a police officer was a threat in your home, you could shoot a police officer. You know, these are the kinds of things that we're now seeing in a variety of states, and it's troubling. So, you know, what I would recommend, you know, for folks going forward is to look at their state legislators and see if they're members of ALEC, and you know, use that as a piece, you know, a piece when deciding who are not to vote, you know, who to vote for.
All right, got a question from Sharon. She wants you to give your gut reaction, first assessment from for some prominent Louisiana politicos, Governor Bobby Jindal. What do you know about him? Quickly,
Bobby Jindal. You know, Bobby Jindal, I think now is probably feels somewhat vindicated after Marco Rubio's response that, you know, because Bobby Jindal didn't have a very good response when he did the response. He lived and is now doing okay. Like, it didn't hurt in the end his long-term national prospects. I think his recent speech saying that Republicans have become the stupid party and we need to move beyond that, I think that has helped rehabilitate his views toward him nationally. He probably feels vindicated by Marco Rubio's, you know, Watergate in his response where he, you know, had dry mouth and had to stop and take a sip of water. So, you know, I think those two things have kind of improved Bobby Jindal's views. Still, ultimately, though, he's you know, quite conservative, quite more conservative than the nation is overall. You know, remains to be seen if he can sort of emerge as a national leader. And really, though, you know,
Okay.
find some policies that can bring people together.
Mary Landrieu,
you know, she's gonna have a tough re-election, but as I said, I wouldn't count her out. She's definitely gone through tough elections before, and you know, knows what it takes to win in Louisiana.
David Vitter
is one of the luckiest senators in the country. I mean, why David Vitter remains and Anthony Weiner resigns, you know, I can't explain.
Buddy. He got reelected, going away, landslide.
I know.
What does that say about Louisiana?
I guess it says that they are tolerant sorts. But, you know, but
we're forgiving. We believe in redemption in Louisiana, Margie.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm pretty sure that they believe in, you know, they're pretty tolerant about such things in Brooklyn and Queens and New York. I mean, that's where I'm from. And, you know, I don't know. I just can't explain it.
Dorothy on Goodwood, please be brief. Dorothy, you're on with Margie. Hi, Dorothy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you see a Democrat comeback in 2014 due to the congressional disapproval ratings?
Certainly that's the hope, right? Here are the challenges. So the challenge is midterm election turnout is going to be a little bit different than presidential election turnout. In presidential years, you have folks who vote a little bit less frequently. You have younger voters, minority voters who don't always vote in every single election will vote in a presidential election. So you have that, you know, as an obstacle. The other obstacle, as I mentioned before, are gerrymandered districts, where you have districts, you had a lot of Republican legislatures that were in charge of drawing the maps, the new congressional maps. And so you have some states where new districts are really set up in a way that, like Pennsylvania would be one example, or North Carolina and others, that hurt Democrats and make the Republican districts even more Republican. So there's less of a base for Democrats to really do well in a midterm election. So those are the two, you know, those are the two challenges. But I'll tell you, though, you know, congressional approval, you're right, is in the dumps, and it has been now for a while. And the outspoken symbols of Republicans kind of run amok, like Joe Walsh in Illinois, who would scream at his constituents, or Alan West in Florida, you know, similarly, you know, angry. Those kinds of folks lost, and they lost because voters decided, you know, that's just not what they want. They don't want people screaming. They want people working together. So, you know, we'll see if this, you know, the trend that we saw this past year will continue, and, you know, hopefully it does.
Well, thank you, Margie O'Meara. Pleasure to visit with you, and hope we do so again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye. 297-5633 is your number. We're joined in studio by Joey Watson. He's at LSU's Music and Dramatic Arts Building, received his MA in rhetoric, and he is here to talk about something called TEDxLSU. Good morning, Joey.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you.
You received your degree in rhetoric.
Correct.
Now, here we just heard from Margie O'Meara, who's a fascinating lady, bright, charming, is on her way, on the fast track. She's been on national programs like Hardball and others. And I counted her saying, you know, more than 100 times in about a 10-15-minute conversation.
Sure.
Why are we so lax in our speech patterns now as a people?
Oh, I think there's a number of factors that contribute to that, one of which would probably be the invention of our social media and technology. We've certainly become more lax or, lackadaisical in our attempts to communicate formally. Some would say in education that our students these days are very savvy via social media, but when you get them in a live interpersonal setting, it can sometimes be challenging for them to have the proper vocabulary as well as the proper cadence.
Well, the other day I heard Senator Landrieu in an interview. It was a three-minute interview. She said, you know, 21 times.
Wow.
U.S. Senator Mary Loretta Landrieu, senior senator from Louisiana, who's been in public life since 1979.
Well, I'm not suggesting that she come back and take a speech communication class or anything like that. She's certainly probably seasoned. I'm sure that different formats and different venues call for, of course, different types of communication styles. So maybe we can let it slide this once.
Well, that brings us to TEDxLSU. You're on the cutting edge of new technology and new media. Tell us what this is about.
Well, the TED Conference, TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, and it was started in 1984 by an architect named Richard Saul Wurman. And the first TED Conference, which eventually became an annual conference held every year in California, the first one flopped. He thought that there was going to be a convergence between the industries of technology, entertainment, and design, and he wanted to bring together the innovators, the movers and shakers in those industries to an annual conference where they could articulate their ideas in 18 minutes or less to give the speech of their life, so to speak. The first one flopped. So around 1990, when those convergences in those fields had happened a little more fluidly and regularly, the conference took off. And you've probably seen a TED Talk. They come a lot via video. You might see them posted on social media, or you might have one emailed to you. And you've probably seen a TED Talk by Hans Rosling or Ken Robinson or Bill Gates or, you know, one of these movers and shakers. And that's where they're coming from, is these TED conferences. Now, TEDx, which is a little different, TEDx, the X standing for an independent organized event. We are sanctioned by TED. We had a license to do this event, but we are locally and independently organized. So we will have a TED-like event at LSU, hence TEDxLSU.
TEDxLSU 2013 is an independently organized event based on the theme of evolution, generating new thought by connecting existing resources. And the inaugural event will take place Saturday, March 9th.
That's correct.
At the Riley Theater, 2 to 8 p.m.
That's correct.
6 hours.
Three 90-minute sessions. We have breaks in between. I've been researching TED for around 6 years. It's the topic of my dissertation. So this is sort of the inaction of that research. It's bigger than that, but that's sort of where it stemmed from. So these things move incredibly fast. The pace of these conferences is remarkable. And so those water cooler breaks in between those sessions, that's where the magic really happens, because you've been rapid fire delivery with these presentations. And so you converge with your fellow audience members during those breaks, and you're just stunned and overwhelmed and inspired by the things that you've heard. And so it's a wonderful opportunity to sort of organize your own thoughts and your own ideas and mesh them with some of the innovators here locally who are doing some pretty fantastic things.
And this will showcase innovative people in our state. They'll give the talk of their life.
We hope.
around the power of ideas in 18 minutes.
18 minutes or less, yeah. Yeah. Some of them are talking 6 minutes, some nine, some 12. Again, it just there's no pauses, so we just sort of rapid fire go. And some of them are explicitly connected in the session. Some of them are more.
But if you gave Bobby Jindal the same script you gave me, it might take me 36 minutes to say what he says in 18 minutes.
We cut him off.
That's not fair.
Sorry, Governor Jindal.
You'd have to cut me off. You have to cut me off.
Well, it is certainly the time challenge is something that the speakers are probably wary of going in. I know a few of them have expressed a little concern because they tend to be a little verbose, but you know, that's something that the format is predicated upon, in that, you know, the audience expects you to be very articulate, very very well organized when you come in. You have to bring your A game, so to speak.
And who are some of the speakers?
Well, locally, I think some of the most interesting people are Camille Manning Broom. You've got Casey Phillips, Brian Dixon, Raymond Jetson.
All of these people, I think, have been guests on our show.
Well, there you go. We're obviously great minds, right? Think alike.
Zach Copland?
Zach Copland, I think, is going to be an interesting little mix in there. He's going to add something great to the mix.
Cycling enthusiast Mark Martin
absolutely.
Will ride in for
Pat
the event.
Pat Fellows is in there, too.
Yeah.
We've got a really, really interesting eclectic mix, and we're trying to hit sort of education, community, as well as entrepreneurship. Those are sort of our sub-themes.
Zach Godshall, the filmmaker?
Zach Godshall's a really cool guy. Yeah. You know Zach?
He's been on the show.
Oh,
yes,
cool.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mary Stein?
Mary Stein is a really neat person.
Yeah, I went to school with Mary.
Oh, really?
Several years ago.
Well, she is just so enthusiastic and energetic, and she's going to sort of talk about digital curation and where our library and information sciences fields are headed in the next 10 years.
And all of these people have to do this in 18 minutes or less.
That's correct.
Or less. So if people start applauding, that could mess up the time, too. You don't want any applause until the end, do you?
We try to save it. I'm sure some will sneak in, but we'll try to keep it going as quickly as possible.
Well, what makes a good 18-minute address?
Well, I think when you can boil down an issue to the bare core, you know, I mean, I think that if you can be very succinct, I tell all of my speakers that if you can come up with a catchphrase, it's three words to maybe 12 words, that summarizes the heart or the essence or the core of what your message is, and you repeat that catchphrase, it'll stick. And so I think any speaker that can boil something down to the very essence or core of what it is that's at the heart of that issue, I think we want to hear from. And of course, you want them to be passionate and energetic, and I think everybody on our roster is going to give you that for sure.
Well, Joey is a native of Memphis, the great city. I'm sure you grew up listening to Elvis, Aaron Presley.
I did.
Others. Aretha Franklin, also born in
Memphis. I think it starts in the womb there.
Yeah. 25-year veteran of the film industry. You've made films. I understand you had one last year. I'm sorry I don't know much about it, but I want to know more. Traipsing Blindly?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, I tend to do sort of I've worked in the industry, and I've worked out of the industry, and so it's much more fun for me to work out of the industry in terms of an independent format. I like the creative freedom, and I like the ability to sort of work on my own and do my own stories and so on.
And you've directed three films at LSU?
Correct. And teaching a graduate course now in the Department of Theater and Film, where we're making a movie this semester. So hopefully you'll be seeing that in the near future as well. Good group of people there working on that.
What are you doing this semester?
Well, finishing the dissertation.
Well, as far as this particular film.
We're working on an original script that we all wrote. It's called Calculations, and it is sort of in the vein of Raymond Carver, Robert Altman, where we have multiple narratives, multiple storylines all intersecting at once, and it's about a day in the life in Baton Rouge, so it's got a local flair to it.
Very good. Now, you did something called the Fellini Project, which was screened at the Federico Fellini Institute and Museum in Italy?
That's correct. In 2009, I was fortunate enough to go with Dr. Succi and Dr. Bongiorni, both at LSU, as a sort of a resident filmmaker on that trip. We went to Rimini and Rome and visited sort of Fellini's sites that he shot many of his films for. And I was fortunate enough to make a documentary about that pedagogy and that process. And that was eventually screened at the Fellini Institute following that.
Why are you wearing a Dodgers cap?
I'm a Dodgers guy.
Well, they bought the best team money can buy.
Well, we'll see. I don't know. They certainly, you know, folks out there are a little concerned. You know, they've spent a lot of money and they're renovating that stadium. And of course, it's a beautiful stadium. So we'll see how that works out.
Favorite Dodger of all time for Joey?
Oh gosh, you know, Ron Say maybe.
Ron Say.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna throw that.
Ron the Penguin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
He was a good third baseman. Played in the same era as Michael Jack Schmidt. Not in the same league with Mr. Schmidt, who led the National League in homers 8 times with the Philadelphia Phillies and was a 3-time most valuable player, while Ron Say was toiling at third base with the Dodgers in the same infield with Davey Lopes, Bill Russell, and Steve Garvey. We'll be interested in seeing what happens with Ted, ex-LSU. Thank you, Joey.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great weekend and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.